This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
As the nuclear accidents at Fukushima, Japan, and Chernobyl taught us, a nuclear accident anywhere affects my listeners around the world. Donald Trump sat down for dinner with a nuclear lobbyist the other night. He wants more taxpayer money and higher electricity rates, now that the coal and nuclear industries have gone bankrupt. We cover the scam with longtime nuclear campaigner Kevin Camps. Then strange new science says plants in a high-carbon atmosphere will determine who gets the crops and who gets the drought. We'll hear from Dr. Pierre Gentin from the Columbia University School of Engineering and Applied Science. The future is already here on Radio EcoShock. Donald Trump's administration has landed another no-win situation. Should his clueless Energy Secretary Rick Perry order subsidies to keep old nuclear reactors and polluting coal plants going, even as they go bankrupt? That would please big donors to the Trump campaign, but it might not make the millions of people in Trump-voting states in the Midwest happy when they get higher electricity bills for years to come. We're back in that un-merry-go-round as the big power company First Energy declared bankruptcy. Three risky reactors could close, but is it a ploy for more public money into a privately held corporation? It's time to ask one of my favorite nuclear correspondents, Kevin Camps, from the nonprofit Beyond Nuclear. Kevin, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much, Alex.
So you say there's news on that right in today's paper.
Yeah, Steve Mufson in the Washington Post broke the story today that Donald Trump will be sitting down for dinner with a top lobbyist from First Energy Nuclear, who happened to be the campaign manager for Rick Perry's presidential bid in the past. So I wonder what they'll be talking about.
Well, isn't that a coincidence?
Yeah, you know, it is kind of scary. It's a really outrageous proposal that First Energy put forth just days ago under the Federal Power Act. It's called a 202C emergency petition, and it's usually reserved for national emergencies like wartime or a natural disaster. The only emergency here is that First Energy has been making very bad business decisions for not years but decades, and they would like the Department of Energy to bail them out massively. And what's scary is that Rick Perry has attempted to, even just this year, he applied to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to bail out the entire coal and nuclear industry nationwide, but it would be especially beneficial to First Energy. And that argument was, boy, coal and nuke plants have storage of fuel on site. So, you know, if something happens like a polar vortex, they're going to have fuel on site. And that thing fell flat on its face. There was large resistance from competitors, other industries, other fuel sources, but also environmental groups, consumer groups. And there was contradictory information. For example, coal sometimes freezes in severe winter weather and can't be used to generate electricity. So that failed, but it just shows the lengths to which Rick Perry is willing to go to try to bail out the coal and nuclear industries.
Yeah, there's an emergency, all right. It's in my pocketbook. Would you give me a whole bunch of money, billions of dollars, please? You know, I'd like to start talking a little bit about some of the nuclear plants that could close if all goes well. And let's start with the Davis-Besse nuclear plant near Toledo, Ohio. Why would it be a relief, Kevin, for everyone if that old plant closes down a little early?
We've been very active on Davis-Besse for a long time because it is one of the most risky reactors, not only in the U.S., but probably in the world. It's had more close calls with catastrophe than any single reactor that I know of. It's a three-mile island twin design. In fact, it had a precursor incident about 18 months before the three-mile island Unit 2 meltdown. Fortunately, it got resolved at Davis-Besse, but was kept secret. I wonder why. And the information was not communicated to the twin design at Three Mile Island Unit 2, and that one had a 50% meltdown. And then you just keep going. It's had a half dozen or more near misses. One of the most infamous was in 2002. It was called the hole in the head fiasco, where the reactor lid had a massive corrosion hole in it, It was covered up by the company at the highest levels and came within literally 3/16 of an inch of breaching, because that was all that was left, was stainless steel liner, and it was bulging through the hole and was soon to burst. And that's how close they came to having a meltdown. And then we learned in 2011 that Davis Bessie's containment, its concrete shield building, is severely cracked, has been since 1978. And the cracking is worsening over time. So if they had had a meltdown at any of these close calls, the containment would not have held it in, and it would have been a catastrophic release of hazardous radioactivity into the environment. So for safety's sake, Davis Bessie must be shut down.
Yeah, we won't even mention the fact that it was hit by a tornado that sent them off running on backup generators. Look, wasn't First Energy fined millions of dollars for lying about reactor safety at Davis Bessie?
Yeah, I believe that would be the hole-in-the-head fiasco. It was a record-breaking fine by the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, $33 million, if memory serves. And the Department of Justice had scathing words to say about First Energy's behavior. And then First Energy tried to essentially perpetrate insurance fraud. They gave one version of events about the hole-in-the-head to the NRC. They gave the opposite version of events to their own insurance company, trying to make it look like they had nothing to do with this. It just happened. How could they have known? And the insurance company, of course, was a little skeptical, and they didn't get away with it. But this is a crooked company, and that's another whole kettle of fish regarding, you know, the safety risks involved.
Well, Kevin, give me a minute to rant about another nuclear myth that bothers me. There is another First Energy nuclear plant, the Beaver Valley Power Station near Shippingport, Pennsylvania, and it's pretty darn close to Pittsburgh. And that whole area has been nuclearized for a long time. Shippingport, as you know, was the site of the first supposed civilian nuclear power station. And I say supposed because that first reactor was really designed for an aircraft carrier that was never built. And because the Atoms for Peace program, pushed by General Eisenhower, always hoped to support a continuing nuclear industry, I think, to make atomic weapons. And now they tell us that Shippingport, that reactor's all cleaned up. The public can tour around the site. But it's cleaned up because they put the whole reactor on a barge and they brought it to Washington State near me. They just buried the reactor in the badly run Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Nothing was cleaned up at all, really. And that's the truth about nuclear power. There's no way to decontaminate a reactor permanently. We just try to hide that radioactivity somewhere else and hope it doesn't escape. That's practically your whole job at Beyond Nuclear. Is it true that it's a myth that we can clean this stuff up when these plants do shut down?
Yeah, they really are lying in a bad way. That's a whole other aspect of this First Energy bankruptcy. It's announced closures of a total of four atomic reactors, because there's two units at Beaver Valley still operating. Is Environmental Law and Policy Center in Chicago, to give credit where credit is due, they just filed an emergency enforcement petition of their own at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, pointing out that First Energy Nuclear's decommissioning trust funds are woefully inadequate for the job ahead. So if they do shut Davis Bessie in 2020, as they've announced, and then Perry in Ohio and Beaver Valley Units 1 and 2 in 2021 in Pennsylvania there, then the decommissioning is ahead. And what Environmental Law and Policy Center has pointed out to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is there is not enough money to do an adequate cleanup job. So they have to dismantle the facilities. They have to clean up the radioactive contamination in the soil, in the groundwater, in the flora, in the fauna. And like you said about the reactor pressure vessel from Shippingport, which was essentially Beaver Valley Unit 1, it wasn't called that, going out to Hanford Nuclear Reservation, to Richland, Washington, to be buried in an unlined ditch. There are so many problems here. What they do during cleanup is they transfer the contamination somewhere else to a dump site. So right now, as we speak, with the growing number of decommissioning projects going on, the biggest ever in U.S. history at Zion, Units 1 and 2, north of Chicago, they send the radioactive contaminations to places like Clive, Utah. That's called Energy Solutions. It can take the lowest category of so-called low-level radioactive waste. Then you've got Waste Control Specialists Limited Liability Corporation in West Texas on the New Mexico state line. They take Class A, Class B, and Class C. So now you're getting more and more intensively radioactive, and they're dumping it above the Oglala Aquifer. And, you know, every single so-called low-level radioactive waste dump in U.S. history, there have been more than a half dozen, have leaked. So Barnwell, South Carolina is infamous for that. Beatty, Nevada actually experienced geysers of radioactive waste, if you can believe it, explosions of radioactive waste, because they had mixed the radioactive waste there with explosive, on contact with water, sodium metal. And so this was a couple years ago. They had a flash flood in Beatty, Nevada, and they had geysers shooting radioactive waste some 50-plus feet into the air. So that's how low-level radioactive waste disposal is going in the United States.
Wow. When it comes to FirstEnergy, too, you know, Kevin, the company that just declared bankruptcy, it goes beyond nuclear to coal. And according to the Wall Street Journal, the biggest coal supplier to FirstEnergy plants is Murray Energy. The CEO of the company, Robert E. Murray, and that's the guy who tried to sue John Oliver. Murray donated millions to the Trump campaign. Then he called on the Department of Energy to supplement the price of coal. That was turned down so far. What the heck happened to the free market?
Yeah, Murray is a huge coal supplier to FirstEnergy. FirstEnergy is $2.8 billion in debt, and that includes not being able to fulfill coal transportation contracts with its vendors. So, you know, I don't have any evidence that Murray's invited to this private dinner tonight, but FirstEnergy's top lobbyist is, who ran Rick Perry's presidential campaign. And so, you know, Murray tried earlier to get Rick Perry and Donald Trump to declare a national emergency surrounding his business, his decision to go coal decades ago. Well, guess what? Coal is in deep trouble right now. And so the national emergency for people like Murray and for FirstEnergy is that they made very bad investments in the past, and it has caught up to them. And they would like, you know, the Trump administration to bail them out to the tune of not really billions, but really hundreds of billions, because that earlier Rick Perry application to FERC, that figure was something like $180 billion over time for coal and nuclear subsidies. And didn't get away with that one. And here comes FirstEnergy again, trying yet again.
And FirstEnergy tries to say that their nuclear and coal generating stations are some kind of baseload necessity and the system could not run safely without them. Kevin Camps, would any of those Midwest states go dark without that nuclear power?
There's something like a 30% higher than that, over 30% glut of electricity on the PJM grid, especially close in to Ohio and northwest Pennsylvania. 30% excess of electricity. They have plenty of backup electricity to spare, too much, actually. And PJM, the Pennsylvania, Jersey, Maryland grid, the largest in the country, it actually extends to Illinois, they have fired back immediately on this talk by FirstEnergy of an emergency blackouts if these plants shut down 3 years from now. PJM is fighting back. But, you know, as I say that, there are moves afoot even within PJM itself to try to subsidize at least nuclear, if not also coal, if not other sources of fossil fuel electricity. So we have to be vigilant against PJM, but this current FirstEnergy proposal is outlandish in PJM's eyes. So it's desperation by FirstEnergy. But they've been trying for over 5 years to get subsidies at the state level in Ohio, at the federal level time and time again, and we just keep fighting them off as best we can.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex, and my guest is Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear. We're talking about the bankrupt nuclear industry and whether the taxpayers and the ratepayers should just fund it all now that the investors are losing money. According to Wikipedia, the FirstEnergy nuclear plants, like the Perry plant near Cleveland, are expected, as you say, to close around 2020, 21, maybe. That's just 3 or 4 years from now anyway. They're old. They're costly to keep up. Do you think they will close then, Kevin, or are their licenses going to be extended forever?
Well, we tried to block the Davis-Bessey license extension, which was a 2017 to 2037 license extension. The NRC rubber stamped it anyway in late 2015. This, despite everything I mentioned earlier about the many close calls with catastrophe at Davis-Bessey over the decades, even recently, and the fact that the containment is severely cracked and worsening with time, which means there is no containment. In fact, the containment is so bad in terms of cracking at Davis-Besse that it is a risk of causing a meltdown, because if they have spalling of exterior face concrete on the outside of the shield building, it would fall down onto, perhaps it could fall down onto, safety significant systems, structures, and components down below. It could initiate the meltdown. And I say all that just to say that these reactors, for safety reasons, should be shut down as soon as possible. 3 or 4 more years of operations really represents a form of radioactive Russian roulette on the Lake Erie shoreline in northern Ohio and on the Beaver River, which feeds the Ohio in northwest Pennsylvania. And Perry has, you know, skeletons in its closet. It's infamous for worker overexposures to radioactivity. It has a very lax safety culture. Beaver Valley is infamous, as revealed by Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds in Vermont, for having a breached containment as well. And that goes back to construction of the containment. They left equipment in the containment that actually formed a breach through the wall. And that was the soft spot where the radioactivity and the pressure would have found a way out in the event of a core meltdown, which could still happen.
Tell us more, Kevin, about what has happened in other states regarding subsidizing old nuclear plants.
Well, unfortunately, at least thus far, we've lost that battle in places like New York State, a $7.6 billion subsidy by ratepayers. This is Governor Andrew Cuomo, a Democrat, who made this happen, and his Public Service Commission. $7.6 billion bailout to keep 4 old reactors operating another 12 years. And it's under court review. Some really great groups like Nuclear Information and Resource Service are suing the Cuomo administration and the Public Service Commission over this ratepayer robbery, essentially. And the money was stolen from a clean energy fund, if you can believe that. Some of those reactors had actually announced shutdown as early as January of 2017, I think it was. And that bailout reversed that shutdown announcement. And the company that is entirely benefiting from this massive subsidy is Exelon Nuclear of Chicago. And speaking of Illinois, we also have lost that battle thus far in Illinois. $2.35 billion to keep 3 old reactors operating another 10 years. And again, Exelon had announced shutdown dates for those reactors. And what the pattern shows is the nuclear utilities, Exelon, First Energy, use these threatened shutdowns as a sort of nuclear hostage taking. They say, oh, all these jobs are going to be lost. All these municipal tax revenues are going to dry up. Well, you know, reactors have to shut down someday. They need to be planning for that transition. It needs to be a just transition for the workforce and the host communities. But they're just playing games with people's lives, livelihoods, community support in the form of tax revenues and charitable donations that they give, which is pocket change for them, actually. And in addition, the safety risks. And these games have got to stop.
Meanwhile, we have a couple of billionaire kids hiring a former environmentalist to look like there's public support to keep the old nuclear plants going until they finally blow up. But there isn't that public support. Talk to us about Rachel Pritzker.
Yeah, I wish I understood her thinking. The Pritzkers are the heirs of the Hyatt Hotel fortune. And I don't think that all the Pritzker siblings are pro-nuclear, but Rachel apparently is very pro-nuclear, to the point where my first encounter with this was the propaganda film called Pandora's Promise, which we did a lot of work to try to rebut, which featured Michael Schellenberger of the Breakthrough Institute, who claimed to have parents who are anti-nuclear. He used to be anti-nuclear until he thought about it, and he came out pro-nuclear. And the film was ironic because they were really featuring a reactor technology called the Integral Fast Reactor, which failed in the 1950s. That was what was so ironic, was this is not a new reactor design. This is an ancient reactor design that already has shown that it's a failure. That's what they were pushing in this film. And now, unfortunately, Michael Schellenberger, still supported by Rachel Pritzker's money, and he gave her a huge thanks in the film, and so did Stone, the filmmaker, for all the support. He now has new adventures underway, a group called Environmental Progress, very Orwellian name, another group called Mothers for Nuclear, just a horrendous name. They happen to be moms who work as reactor control room operators, so they have no bias there. And they are showing up in places like Ohio, Illinois, California, trying to keep these old reactors operating. So one of the, you know, more ironic moments was when Schellenberger organized a Mothers for Nuclear protest at Greenpeace offices in San Francisco, protesting the decision to shut down the Diablo Canyon reactors in 2024 and 2025. What was ironic was the company made that decision, Pacific Gas and Electric, yes, in discussions with environmental groups, but not Greenpeace. Greenpeace was not at the table. It was Natural Resources Defense Council. It was Friends of the Earth. It was Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. It was the nuclear workforce unions. So why did they go to Greenpeace? I mean, it's this weird PR campaign that Schellenberger's up to. It's very cynical, and we fight him at every opportunity.
Yeah, years ago I did a two-part series on Michael Schellenberger and the Breakthrough Institute, which really never made any breakthroughs, and they set up this so-called institute at a California shopping mall. He and Ted called themselves senior fellows, even though they had no academic training to speak of. They took money from big foundations. Then I see that in January 2016, Schellenberger split off with his own, more or less taking one of the prime donors with the Breakthrough Institute to fund his new group, Environmental Progress, as you say. It was Rachel Pritzker, and their idea of green is to keep old reactors going. And Schellenberger cites as, quote, "Environmental Progress's biggest victories were saving America's largest source of clean energy, nuclear power, in Illinois and New York. We did so by building a humanistic environmental movement demanding energy justice for all." I mean, that's some kind of nuclear astroturfing. It's unbelievable.
It's environmental injustice, of course, because the ratepayers are getting gouged. And, you know, there are human beings, they use the word human there, who happen to be low income. They happen to be people of color many times. They can't afford these rate hikes that the nuclear subsidies represent. I was in First Energy country. I was in Akron, Ohio, where First Energy is headquartered. This was January of 2014. It was First Energy's attempt to get a massive $4-plus billion bailout out of the state of Ohio Public Utilities Commission public comment meeting in Akron. And I was heartbroken to be listening to young women, some were single moms, saying that if my electricity bill goes up any higher, I'm going to be homeless. And the hearing happened to be taking place during blizzard conditions. And it was just like, you got to be kidding me. And it's why groups like ARP are our allies on this, because seniors can't afford these rate hikes. And that is who's going to face the music, is people paying electricity bills, households, no matter how low income, small businesses, and even large businesses, major manufacturing corporations are opposing these bailouts because they have to pay those electricity bills. And that's the power of the nuclear lobby, is sometimes they get away with this despite that widespread opposition by essentially everybody else.
And with the Pritzker money and other nuclear donors, Michael Schellenberger sees lots of doors opening. Even though Schellenberger has zero training in nuclear physics and no experience in a nuclear plant, he's on MIT's Future of Nuclear Advisory Board. Michael claims he will give the keynote address at the annual conference of the American Nuclear Society meeting in San Francisco. Environmental Progress opened a 5,000-square-foot office and action center at street level, just three blocks from UC Berkeley. So, Kevin, I suppose they hope they can indoctrinate students and maybe gather up some misguided street power. It's fantastic mirroring of the environmental movement, only with really big bucks instead of scraping by. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's spinning the splitting of the atom. It's a PR exercise. Astroturfing is the perfect phrase to use for it. You know, another MIT pro-nuclear advocate is Ernest Moniz, who was Obama's energy secretary, who went through the revolving door to join the board of Southern Nuclear recently after, in 2014, giving Southern Nuclear an $8.3 billion federal taxpayer-backed nuclear loan guarantee, which then Trump administration just topped off with another $3.7 billion. So now you got a nice even $12 billion of federal taxpayer money at risk at Vogtle Units 3 and 4 in Georgia. And Moniz is sitting at the table now making the decisions on that going forward when it should have been canceled a long time ago. So Moniz, most recently in the First Energy context, incredibly, it was a national context, but First Energy is where the action is right now. He said, we have to keep our nuclear power industry going because the training and the know-how and the trained personnel are essential for our nuclear weapons arsenal. And what's astounding about that argument is that they've denied that for 7 decades. There is no connection between Atoms for Peace and Atoms for War. They're completely separate from each other. Well, Dr. Arjun Makhazani of Institute for Energy and Environmental Research wrote a book in 1999 called The Nuclear Power Deception. And he used primary documents going all the way back showing that, no, in fact, this Atoms for Peace speech that Eisenhower gave in 1953 at the United Nations was a smiley face facade for the nuclear weapons buildup. Where was all the uranium going? Yes, there was shipping port, which happened to be built, like it was built, like you said, by Admiral Hyman Rickover and his nuclear Navy men. So much for a civilian reactor, right? But it was an electricity generator for the Pittsburgh area. But where was all that uranium going in those first years and even decades, the 50s, the 60s, before there were many reactors at all? It was going into the nuclear weapons arsenal. So it was a justification for uranium mining and milling and processing and enrichment. It was feeding the nuclear arms race. So here we go. Now they're reversing their argument and saying we need Atoms for Peace so that we can be prepared to continue Atoms for War. And that's Moniz out of MIT. He's a nuclear engineering prof up there.
You know, I always knew it. We all always knew it. And now the documentation is coming out and now people are admitting it. You talked about mothers for nuclear power, and I looked into 3 or 4 of them, and one wasn't a mother, and all of them seemed to work in the nuclear industry, so they just want to keep their jobs. But wouldn't real mothers be more concerned about leukemia clusters around the nuclear plants?
That's what's so cynical about what Schallenberger and his compatriots are up to. A lot of anti-nuclear groups actually grow out of leukemia, childhood leukemia support groups. I shouldn't say a lot, but some, and some powerful ones, like Cumbrians Opposed to a Radioactive Environment Core near the Sellafield nuclear complex in the United Kingdom. It actually grew out of a childhood leukemia support group. That's how I got started. Another similar story in Illinois, a mother whose daughter contracted a rare form of childhood brain cancer near the Braidwood and Dresden nuclear power plants in Illinois, only to find out that there were 5 rare childhood brain cancers at one elementary school where this young girl, 7 years old, went. The good news is she has survived. She's in remission. She's in her 20s now. Some of the other children did not. So that's what's going on. There have been studies in Germany where the closer you live to a nuclear power plant, the higher your risk of childhood leukemia. The International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War looked into it. And their concern is the refueling outages, that is when the worst radioactive discharges are taking place, you know, without accidents. This is routine radiation discharges as they refuel the atomic reactor. You know, no talk of evacuating the local population during refueling. We, of course, would like to abolish nuclear power, but just to keep everything seemingly clean in a PR sense, we don't even talk about it to the public. In fact, we deny there's any risk. When there have been voices calling for at least temporary evacuations from the neighborhood while they refuel to spare children who are very much at risk because of their developing immune system, the division of their cells as they grow, they're at a heightened risk from the harm and hazard of radioactivity. No talk about, you know, getting people out of the way during these very dangerous time periods. So that's why what Schallenberger and Mothers for Nuclear are up to is so outrageous.
And he's all about the catchphrase. I mean, they call themselves atomic humanists and eco-modernists, and they claim to know how to save nature with disruptive technological change. I think these people hold a world record for dangerous green BS. That's my opinion.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex, and my guest is Kevin Camps from Beyond Nuclear.
Yeah, I mean, one aspect of nuclear power that is very dangerous is the weapons proliferation that goes hand in hand with it. So as we speak, we have Saudi Arabia and lobbyists in the U.S. that is hired on Capitol Hill trying to get Congress to approve a nuclear power commerce deal with Saudi Arabia so that they can build 16 new reactors. And we've been warning, and many others, that if Saudi Arabia gets nuclear power, if they get uranium enrichment, if they get plutonium reprocessing, they could build a nuclear weapons arsenal with that. I mean, Mohammed El-Baradei, the director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, who's himself Egyptian, warned about that some years ago before he left and retired, Nobel Peace Prize in hand for his work on Iraq and Iran. But now we have the crown prince of Saudi Arabia in the last couple of weeks warning explicitly out loud that if Iran builds a nuclear weapon, Saudi Arabia will do so as well. So it's not just others warning about it. It's an openly admitted threat against Iran.
Well, that's what Mike Flynn, the disgraced Mike Flynn, got caught for heading to the Middle East while he was on the Trump campaign or in the administration trying to sell nuclear reactors in the Mideast and then not declaring that.
Yes, exactly. It's a little-known aspect of the whole Russiagate and, Trump corruption, so to speak. So, the crazy thing is, not only is there the nuclear weapons proliferation potential, there's the risk of nuclear power plants being targeted in warfare or by terrorism. So there was a book written in 1984 by Bennett Ramberg entitled Nuclear Power Plants as Weapons for the Enemy. They essentially represent massive dirty bombs just sitting there waiting to be detonated to cause unimaginable harm to the local region out to a great distance. So it'd be an intentional, Fukushima or an intentional Chernobyl in that respect. So if you're going to build reactors in the Middle East, you're really asking for trouble. And just a case in point, about 2 months ago, I think, several weeks back, the Houthi rebels in Yemen fired a missile at a nuclear power plant in the United Arab Emirates that's under construction. It's not yet activated, so it's not yet radioactive. There was no fuel in the core, but it was the Houthi rebels warning United Arab Emirates and by implication Saudi Arabia, their biggest adversary of all, that they're in open warfare with, that we can target your nuclear power plants. So those are the kind of risks of building nuclear power plants in the Middle East. I mean, Israel took out Iraq's Ozerok reactor in 1981, I think it was. More recently, 2007, they took out a secretive Syrian nuclear power plant that was being built in cooperation with North Korea. So those are two examples, yet again, of pre-operational nuclear power plants being bombed by the Israeli military. The U.S. military, incredibly, in 1991, bombed an Iraqi research reactor that was operational, which means there was some radioactive releases to the environment. I don't know how bad it was. The fuel had been taken out of the core, but when you bomb a reactor that's been operational, it is radioactive and there will be releases.
And didn't Bin Laden have a sort of secondary plan of just taking those airplanes into the Indian Point reactor outside New York, which would cause millions of people to be irradiated?
Well, Mohammed Atta, the lead attacker in the first plane that hit the World Trade Center, wanted to attack Indian Point, lobbied for it within Al-Qaeda, was told no. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11, under torture, admitted that the original plan was for 10 hijacked jetliners, two of which were to target nuclear facilities. And when an Al Jazeera reporter, prior to his capture, asked him why nuclear plants were not targeted, he said Al-Qaeda did not want things to get out of hand. So we rely on the moral restraint of terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda because of the incredible vulnerability of our nuclear power plants. And it's not the reactor per se, although that could melt down in such an attack for sure. It's the pools of high-level radioactive waste storage that are not in radiological containment. They're in industrial warehouse-type buildings that could unleash mega catastrophes if they lose their cooling water. So case in point, Fukushima Daiichi Unit 4, the Japanese prime minister at the time, had a secret contingency plan in the works that if that pool went up in flames, and it almost did, was through sheer luck that it didn't, he was planning to evacuate 35 to 50 million people from Metro Tokyo and Northeast Japan because of the radioactive releases that would have happened. And he said it would have been the end of the Japanese state.
And we should pay more just to keep that threat going and hope that no terrorist blows it up or they don't have an accident or the top of it doesn't melt through. It's terrible. It's a terrible situation. So now, Kevin, it's time to let you out of the box on your favorite nuclear power plant. Go ahead and tell us about your roots with the Palisades Nuclear Generating Station.
Yeah, I'd worked on nuclear weapons before in a younger day, but then when I returned home, I learned of Palisades, which I hadn't known about growing up in Kalamazoo, Michigan. It's, again, as I said about Davis Bessie, Palisades is one of the riskiest nuclear power plants in the United States. It is the most embrittled reactor pressure vessel in the United States, with a close second over at Point Beach, Wisconsin, right across Lake Michigan. So poor Lake Michigan is wedged between the two most embrittled pressurized water reactors in the United States. And what it means is, if they ever activate the emergency core cooling systems at either of those reactors, it could be like a hot glass under cold water, only under 2,000 pounds of pressure per square inch. That's a pressurized water reactor. And they could fracture through wall the reactor pressure vessel. And if that happens, there is no contingency to prevent the core meltdown. The last line of defense is going to be the containment to try to keep it bottled up and not get out. But as we've discussed, containments sometimes fail. And at Fukushima Daiichi, we saw catastrophic failure of containment. So that's one risk going on at Palisades. There are many others. They've never replaced or repaired the reactor lid, even post Davis Bessie's near miss because of a corroded reactor lid. So Palisades has reactor pressure vessel embrittlement, it has reactor lid corrosion, it has steam generator degradation. These are all pathways to meltdown. We really tried hard in 2006 to prevent the license extension at Palisades from 2011 to 2031. NRC rubber stamped it anyway, despite all these risks. And most recently, and heartbreakingly, Palisades had announced a closure date of October 1st, 2018. And because of these bait and switches in New York and Illinois, announced closures that were just used as leverage to win bailouts, we were very skeptical from the start. And sure enough, last September, they said, you know what, we've changed our mind. We're not shutting down. We're going to keep going at least until 2022. They're gouging ratepayers near Palisades under a exorbitant power purchase agreement. And if they want to, if they can orchestrate another power purchase agreement to extend that out to 2031, they have NRC's blessing to just keep going. Palisades should have been shut down a very long time ago, and they are just sailing ever deeper into uncharted risk territory.
The motto at NRC, run them until they blow. How can people find out more about your organization so we really can go beyond nuclear?
Yeah, our website is just www.beyondnuclear.org, and there is a lot there, so just pursue your interests.
We've been speaking with Kevin Camp from Beyond Nuclear, and I will put links to this interview, a bunch of supporting materials, and Kevin's other appearances on Radio EcoShock, all in my own show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you, Alex. It was a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We didn't even get time to talk about the Russian hacking of the nuclear power stations. As revealed in a recent government report, they can turn them off and on, and the news media pretended an adversary would just shut down the reactors, causing a power blackout. Well, that's a big problem, but that's the best-case scenario. Really, as Kevin told me, they could just shut down the safety systems, causing a massive nuclear accident or many of them, like Fukushima. There's another reason to shut down these dangerous old reactors as fast as we can, but no, the government wants to run them until they blow, no matter what the cost to American taxpayers and ratepayers. Okay, let's get to some breaking climate science.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
If you are listening, you are probably a land mammal. So as the world warms abnormally, you want to know whether to prepare for drought, floods, or extreme weather. Scientists model the atmosphere, the soil, and the seas, but new research reveals a surprise. One determining factor is alive, the reaction of plants to more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and it's not what you've heard about. This breaking science comes from the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in a paper published April 2, 2018. The title is Critical Impact of Vegetation Physiology on the Continental Hydrologic Cycle in Response to Increasing CO2, and we'll parse out what that means with our guest, a co-author of the paper. Professor Pierre Gentin heads the Gentin Lab at Columbia Engineering and Earth Institute in New York City. Dr. Gentin is currently on sabbatical at ETH Zurich University in Switzerland. From Zurich, Pierre Gentin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Most of the climate science I deal with talks about greenhouse gases, the state of the ice world, ocean currents, and all that. And from that data, scientists model out the impact of climate changes on agriculture and wild plants. What made you think plants have a more direct role?
Our thinking is that plants are going to regulate whether or not we live in a drier or wetter place, basically. So the idea is that we typically think in terms of either we will have more supplies or more precipitation or snowfall. And so that's typically what we think will provide most of the moisture. And then we have whatever demand we typically get from the atmosphere. So if you have higher temperature, typically you expect to have more demand. So we typically think in terms of either more supply or more demand. And this balance will basically define whether we will live in a drier or wetter world. And what we found is that, in fact, the main regulator of the water cycle and basically of water stress or drying basically as we go into the future are going to be plants. And the reason for that is that they strongly regulate the water cycle as they basically pick up carbon and take up carbon from the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So as you increase carbon dioxide, what happens is that plants are typically fine, and so they tend to regulate or close what we call the stomata, which are really small openings that are at the tip of the leaves or at the end of the leaves. And what it does is that basically they will close their stomata and they will regulate how much they will be transpiring, so how much water is going to flow from the roots to the atmosphere through the leaves. And as a result, because you have more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you will have less typically transpiration. So you will have less flow of water from the roots to the atmosphere. The models, what we found is that what will happen in the future is that this is going to really impact how we actually perceive and how we actually assess droughts and floods as well. And so plants will be the primary regulator of this drying or wetting mechanism.
Well, that's interesting that you say that, because I had some doubts about a statement in the press release from Columbia, and that was attributed to the lead author and the PhD student in your lab, Leo Lemordin. And it says, plants are really the thermostat of the world, but I don't think that's really what he meant, because Richard Alley from Penn State famously said, carbon dioxide is the thermostat of the world. What do you think Leo meant?
Yeah, what he meant is not thermostat in terms of temperature, but what he meant was really thermostat in terms of regulator. That's all. I mean, it wasn't really in terms of, maybe the analogy wasn't great, but he wasn't meaning in terms of temperature. He was really meaning in terms of regulator. So basically, plants are going to adjust whether or not we will be seeing a drier world. So that's what he meant by thermostat.
All right, fair enough. Now, our listeners have heard about feedback loops with things like sea ice disappearing or methane. Talk to us about the feedback loops coming from vegetation.
There are many feedbacks, but to me, the primary one is really between the carbon and water cycle. So one of the biggest unknown in carbon uptake is really related to land carbon uptake, way more than the ocean. I mean, ocean carbon uptake is relatively well-defined, I would say. The land carbon uptake is very, very unknown, and the predictions are pretty uncertain. And most of that is actually related to this coupling between the carbon dioxide cycle and the water cycle at the land surface. And that's, again, related to how plants are going to adjust. So to give you an example is that imagine plants are regulating because you're providing more carbon dioxide. So now they basically feel happier and they want to close partly, I mean, not entirely, but they want to close their stomata. So they want to close some of the opening getting from the roots to the atmosphere. So they are regulating the flow of water and basically evaporation from the roots to the atmosphere. As a result, what's going to change is the amount of moisture you have in the soil. So imagine that now you have more moisture. And so that's going to have also an impact on the evaporation, you know, like salt evaporation, also transpiration from plants. And so basically those two are really, I mean, you have a very strong feedback mechanism between the two. So you increase carbon dioxide, and as a result, you're very strongly modifying the water cycle. But when you're changing the water cycle, it also has really dramatic impact on the carbon cycle. So it's really been shown, for instance, during El Nino, it's pretty well known that we have systematic CO2 source to the atmosphere from most of the tropical land regions. And so we know that when we get into a drought or when we get into a warmer than usual summer or warmer than usual tropical land, we tend to have way more CO2 source to the atmosphere. So it means that those two cycles are very, very tightly coupled. And actually, in my lab, we are trying to use remote sensing data to actually get a sense of what is this coupling, how does it work, and how well are we representing that in models.
For me, this is a bit of strange talk because I've always been told that as the Earth warms, the lands will get drier, and yet it looks like the plants might delay that or the soils might actually become wetter.
So that thinking, and actually I'm using that a lot, you know, in my talks and stuff, that thinking, I think, is actually pretty incorrect. I mean, there's a couple of regions where we have this so-called dry get drier, wet get wetter mechanism. So there's a couple of places like the Mediterranean, South Africa, or Central America, where we kind of know that we expect that those places are going to be drier. But many other places, I would say, it's not that clear. And in fact, the fact that it's so complicated is actually very much related to plants. So if plants were to behave and become very greedy, you know, they would basically pump a lot of water. But they tend, many of them tend to be a little bit more conservative, you know. So meaning that they might not be as greedy as, and so they might limit the amount of moisture they are picking up in the soil. And so, for instance, we are seeing things that are a little bit abnormal. So, for instance, in the southwestern U.S., we are seeing a greening. So you see more green plants than before. But you're seeing, if you were to measure the amount of moisture in the soil, you're actually seeing a drying. So you can have a greening and at the same time a drying as well. So it's not the typical thinking of just drying that will be just bone dry like a desert. But you could have actually more plants because you have more carbon dioxide. So you're basically feeding them. And at the same time, you could have a soil that's a little bit drier. So I think that will be mostly what will happen most in many regions.
Do you think there's a level of carbon dioxide where this plant reaction becomes even more pronounced, like at 600 parts per million CO2 or 800 ppm?
Yeah, we are starting to see already that happening right now. I mean, a lot of it's already, I mean, that's basically what I mentioned. I mean, you can look at, for instance, the southwest U.S. and you can actually look and see those changes, you know. But I think above 600 ppm is going to be a game changer for many of those processes.
If leaf-level water use efficiency increases, as you say in the paper, when there's more CO2 in the air, is it possible some plants can live with less rainfall, maybe even become more drought-tolerant?
Yes, definitely possible, yeah. Yeah, so that's basically the example I was giving in the southwest U.S. So you're increasing this, basically, drought tolerance. And people are also trying to modify plants. So, for instance, they are using or trying to mimic, so you have this so-called CAM, C-A-M, type of photosynthesis. So basically that's how cacti are actually working. And so people are trying to see if we could actually mimic some of that to get that drought tolerance trait. So that could be a way. C4 plants are also pretty well adapted to dry conditions as well. The main point is that we are expecting to get some increase in water use efficiency. I mean, that's the typical thinking. So in a sense, you could say that plants are not that greedy in a sense. They are relatively happy, and carbon is not the main limitation. There are other limitations like nutrients, for instance.
Right. So, Pierre Gentine, you co-authored a paper published in May 2017 titled Regionally Strong Feedbacks Between the Atmosphere and Terrestrial Biosphere. Is it important to understand regional feedbacks if we want to look at the whole climate future?
Yes. I mean, one of the key things is that when we talk about warming, we have, I mean, imagine, like, for instance, if you think about the Paris Agreement, we typically mention a global warming. So let's say 2 degrees Celsius, you know. The trouble will be that land regions have a very little inertia compared to the ocean, because water is the element on the planet that has the biggest inertia. So what it means is that the ocean will warm up much, much slower than land regions. And so what will typically happen is that dry regions in particular are going to be way warmer than those 2 degrees, meaning that the regional impact is going to be way more dramatic, especially over dry regions compared to the global 2 degree average. So if you're looking at a dry region, you could have 4 or 5 degrees, depending. Especially if you start looking at extremes like heat waves, you will see very, very dramatic impact on land regions at a very regional scale, especially, again, in those dry regions.
Last fall, we heard from our Russian guest scientist Anastasia Makareva, and her work suggests that large forests, whether in the Amazon or the boreal, develop air flows and encourage their own weather systems that bring rain all the way from the oceans. What are your thoughts on that?
So I'm actually working on those things. So I think it's actually happening in one part of the Amazon, which is to the west, so closest to Colombia, basically. And that's where you're basically seeing some increase in rainfall, even if you look at the long-term record. But if you start looking to the east, we are seeing basically a drying. So in the Amazon, this dry get drier, wet get wetter type of mechanism tends to apply, even though, but it basically tends to apply. So we tend to see wetter regions that are already wet and drier regions that are already dry, even though, I mean, you can have some regional discrepancies as well. And I would mention that one thing that seems to be altering a lot the story in the Amazon is also land use and cover change, so the fact that we are deforesting there. We're changing the landscape a lot, so that has implications for many things.
Yes, you've said in your paper that the type of vegetation on the land matters a lot. And as we speak, Indonesia and other countries are cutting down dense tropical rainforests to replace them with palm oil plantations. That also would have an impact on regional hydrology, wouldn't it?
Yes, for sure. I mean, one example is if you look at Costa Rica, for instance, they are growing a lot of pineapples there. And pineapples tends to actually be way warmer during the day. So that has actually pretty strong impact, especially in terms of regional temperature. So there's a strong warming, actually. You can see that in Costa Rica during the day, at least. So, yeah, definitely. And that's the same in the Amazon. You can use that. You can look at land cover change and deforestation, and that has pretty dramatic impact in terms of the temperature change. Again, at the regional scale, not global, but mostly regional.
Yes. So if you continue the direction of your research, could it help farmers and governments make long-term plans about what crops to plant?
Yes, I'm collaborating with a couple of people on the sociological impact and trying to see how we could maybe inform basically agricultural farming, especially in tropical regions, and seeing what is the impact that we have across scale. So basically at a very small scale, and what's the regional impact, and when we start for instance, deforesting at a relatively big scale, and what's the impact on climate, what's the impact on water, and what's the impact on nutrients.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I am your host, Alex Smith. Our guest is Professor Pierre Gentine, head of the Gentine Lab at Columbia Engineering and Earth Institute in New York City, but we've reached Pierre in Switzerland. In your paper, what do you mean by continental water stress?
So we mean drying or wetting, but there are many definitions. So that's why we're mentioning continental water stress, because one stress could be a low amount of moisture in the soil. So that's one definition. The other definition would be you want to know if your plants are stressed. So that would be another definition if you're a farmer, for instance. Another definition could be I want to look at runoff. If I'm in, I'm looking at water resource management or like a catchment hydrologist or something. So what we meant is that you can have many different definitions of drying or stress, you know, but those definitions are not always the same. So for instance, the example I gave before, you could have greening. So if you're a farmer, you're happy because you could have, for instance, more yield, but at the same time, you could have a soil that's drier. So you could have things that are a little bit more divergent than what we have right now. And I think that's what is interesting, or at least from a scientific standpoint, with rising CO2, is that some of the definitions of a drought or what is the definition of water stress is going to change somehow. And those definitions are going to be a little bit more divergent somehow. And that's pretty unusual compared to looking at historical records.
Now, the press release from Columbia says your team is, quote, the first to isolate the response of vegetation from the global warming total complex response. For the layperson, Pierre, can you explain what tools your team used to tease out this plant response from the bigger warming picture?
So what we used Earth system models. So those simulations are basically out there. So that's not new, I would say. What's new is the way we actually decompose. So we try to actually quantify in those simulations what is the actual contribution of vegetation. Whereas typically people were looking at the overall response. So they were looking at what is the contribution of everything, including the increase in radiation, the increase in temperature, the change in precipitation, and the impact of vegetation that they typically thought was small. And what we found out was that vegetation had the biggest impact in the end, way more than precipitation and way more than radiation.
And when you say that vegetation will play the determining role or a determining role in controlling the future water cycle on land, that begins to sound a little bit like the original hypothesis from James Lovelock that plants shape their environment to fit their needs. What do you think?
Yeah, actually, that's true, yeah. Yeah, in the end, plants are going to regulate, I mean, to some extent to what they need, you know. I tend to think of them as being not really greedy, so they try to basically adjust to basically what their needs are somehow. And because we are going to provide way more carbon dioxide, so basically we're providing way more food for them. One thing that I should mention is that one thing that's very uncertain is the role of nutrients. So that's one thing that's very uncertain as well, is that how are nutrients going to limit those carbon uptake as well? So that's a big unknown.
And of course, marine experts say the real drama of climate change will play out on the oceans, which are much larger than the land base. Do you have a sense of the balance between the terrestrial ecosphere that you study and the biosphere and the physics of the seas when it comes to climate change?
Yeah, so the ocean is basically picking up more CO2 from the atmosphere, but there's way more unknown in terms of carbon uptake from land. So that's why it's a very big source of uncertainty in current Earth system models. And one of the reasons is basically what I mentioned, is coupling between the water and carbon cycle, which is poorly understood. So that's why we can use new tools like remote sensing to constrain that better. And there's also like all of the nutrients that are going to limit this uptake as well. So that's also a big unknown.
But I know as a gardener, there are points where the heat is just too much for the plants. And I wonder, isn't there also a point where global heating just overwhelms the existing vegetation, possibly leading to deserts?
Yeah, some people are always thinking about it. So there's always this idea, especially in ecology, of tipping point, you know, that if there would be like a given temperature above which there would be a tipping point. I hope to be more optimistic, so I hope that there's no tipping point and that basically plants will be sufficiently plastic and they will adjust somehow. We'll see, yeah, but I hope they're able to adjust somehow.
And Pierre Gentin, you're thinking about doing some research into the implications of extreme heat wave events?
Yes, so we have a couple of papers actually in reviews looking at exactly at those things. So looking at how plants are regulating extremes and how they are also interacting with extremes, yeah.
Negotiators at Paris tried to set 1.5 degrees warming as the safe zone, but we're already touching on that. And now it's 2 degrees C warming as the red line we should not cross. But those numbers are kind of based on human needs. It almost sounds like there's a different scale of danger for the plant world.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. And also for humans, again, as I was mentioning before, I think there's this big difference between, I mean, 1.5 or 2 degrees relatively abstract because that's a global average temperature. But typically what you'll see is that over land, it's going to be way warmer than that. And especially extremes and heat waves are going to be way more impactful than before.
We've been talking about a breakthrough paper on the interaction between climate, the atmosphere, and plant life on land below. The title is Critical Impact of Vegetation Physiology on the Continental Hydrologic Cycle in Response to Increasing CO2. The paper was published April 2nd, 2018 in PNAS. Find links to Pierre's work and the science in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Pierre, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thanks.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's the whole truth from Radio EcoShock this week. You can always post your comments in my show blog at ecoshock.org or write me, radio@ecoshock.org. As always, thank you for listening and caring about our world.